invite you to continue with me in worship and reach for your handout that has at the top the final question Jesus asks his disciples. We've been in this Questions of Jesus series since Epiphany. In the season of Epiphany, we focused on questions that surrounded who Jesus is for us and for the world. But during Lent, we have looked at questions that are connected to crisis and controversy and the rising conflict that Jesus is facing, all of that which leads to the cross. Last week, we focused on a question that we also see in this text. It's the question Jesus raised to his disciples, "Could you not stay awake with me for 1 hour?" But that's not the final question he has for his disciples. He has one more, and it's for a particular disciple, one called Judas. And the question is, "Judas, do you betray me with a kiss?" And when I think of this passage, and I think particularly of that question, a melody comes to mind in my heart and head, because I grew up in a household where every Sunday morning my dad would take this record player that was about this big and this wide. He'd put in Jesus Christ Superstar. It was the version with Ian Gillan from Deep Purple singing the role of Jesus, so he could just scream it. It was wonderful. And we would listen, we'd rock out as we all got ready for church to Jesus Christ Superstar. I'm convinced that the reason why I like the kind of music I like, progressive rock, a bit ostentatious, very dramatic storytelling, is because I was fed with the constant diet of Jesus Christ Superstar growing up. And in that musical, there's a scene called The Arrest. And at The Arrest, which tries to present this passage before us, Jesus asked Judas, "Judas, do you betray me with a kiss?" And then his disciples, who are sleeping, start saying in the best 70s jive there is, "What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening." And that means what's happening for those of you who are not children of the 70s. What's going on? What's the buzz? What I'd like to do is I'd like to show you that very clip, because it does, in an unconventional yet modern way, set the stage for this text that we're about to look at. It incorporates every aspect that I want to highlight in just a moment. And so this is from Jesus Christ Superstar. This is the 2000 version, not the 1970s one I grew up on. They're both excellent. Make sure, Chris, you're listening for the sound, because it starts off pretty silent. Now, in that clip called The Arrest, you have all the elements that we have before us in our text. You have Jesus praying. He's the last one standing, if you will. We used this picture last week, and Jesus here, our text tells us he is in his anguish. The Greek word that's translated anguish here is agonia. And you can tell what English word we get from that. Agony. Anguish. Struggle. Jesus is struggling so much that Luke says sweat is dropping off like drops of blood, like a gladiator in a fight to the death or an athlete that is giving everything in order to win a competition. Jesus is in the very fight of his life. And while he's in the fight of his life, his disciples are sleeping. And while all this is occurring, there is a crowd coming in order to arrest Jesus. We're not told exactly who composes that crowd until verse 52, but when we realize who it actually is, we may be a bit surprised. And so after Jesus challenges disciples, "Why are you still sleeping?" Judas comes and does something very, very interesting. Verse 47, "While he was still speaking, a crowd came suddenly. And the one called Judas, one of the 12," Luke wants to remind us, "was leading them. He approached Jesus to kiss him, but Jesus said to him, 'Judas, is it with a kiss that you're betraying the Son of Man?'" Now, the one thing that the Jesus Christ Superstar doesn't get too well for us is the kiss seems much different than it would have been in the Jewish tradition. In our tradition, when we greet someone with affection and loyalty, when we're committed to them, when we're neighborly with them, we respect them, we hold out our hand. We have a handshake. Or if you're more informal, you hug someone. In the Jewish culture, to show your respect and love and loyalty and affection to another, you'd greet man to man and you'd kiss both sides of the cheeks. You might have seen that before, where there's this customary welcoming of someone. If you are not buddies with another, if you're not close friends, if there's not a loyalty or there's not an affection, you don't do that. But it must have been par for the course for the disciples to greet one another with a kiss. It wasn't outlandish. They regularly greeted one another with this sign of affection and commitment and close confidence. But when Judas comes to give the kiss, he's giving a kiss that is meant to disguise his real intentions. His kiss is somewhat like an unfaithful husband who gives flowers to his wife in order to cover up the fact that he's seeing someone on the side. It is the kind of thing that's meant to give the people he's with a signal, but not to expose that he's the betrayer. He's trying to hide that as best as he can and approach Jesus in the same way. This sign of affection has actually become a signal for Jesus' enemies, mocking the very act of kissing, welcoming, greeting, showing an affection, so that it's disguised, it's not real, it's not legitimate, and Jesus calls him to account on that. "Are you going to betray me with a kiss? Because this kiss isn't a sign of loyalty or affection. This kiss is a signal to have me arrested." Well, while that's happening, the other disciples who've finally come to full awakeness, they in verse 49 see what's coming, and one of them, we're not told who, but other gospels will say that this is Peter. It really doesn't matter. One of them says, "Lord, should we strike with the sword?" And without waiting for an answer, one of them immediately strikes the slave of the high priest in verse 50 and cuts off his ear, which is a way to understand that when Peter goes to strike the high priest's slave, he's not aiming for the ear. His strategy is not to slice off small body parts in a torturous method in order to overcome his enemy. He's going for the throat. He's going for the kill. He's doing what he can to stand up against those who are coming to arrest Jesus. But it's important, particularly in our culture and in our day, to hear the word Jesus says to that. Verse 51, "But Jesus said, 'No more of this.'" Or in Jesus Christ Superstar, "Put away your sword." In a way of saying that this violence is not going to accomplish God's purpose. It definitely needs underscoring in our day and age that the kingdom of God is never advanced by violence. The sword has no place in the church's arsenal. If violence is fought with violence like Peter wants to do, then Peter's kingdom, God's kingdom, Jesus' kingdom is just the same as the kingdoms of the earth. It just uses might or greater power or force to overcome the enemy rather than to win them through love, through forgiveness. And the reason that's so important is, look at verse 51 again. "Jesus said, 'No more of this.' And he touched the slave's ear and healed him." Sometimes we miss that. because we're so caught up in the drama of the whole thing. But it's always important to remember, in Jesus' last week of his life, he doesn't do any miracles except one. He goes to the cross. He has the power to call down 12 legions of angels to save him from the cross. He has the ability to do whatever he wants with this messianic power. And during that final week of conflict and controversy, and particularly during that last 24 hours, he never uses his power to save himself. The only exception is when his enemy is lying there bleeding from a cut one of his disciples made. Jesus reaches down and heals the ear of his enemy, living out what he's been preaching from the beginning: love your enemy. And you see a clear example of how Jesus' kingdom will move forward, not with retaliation, not with bloodshed or rule by might, but it will move forward with love even of enemy. That's important when you see in verse 52 who this band of people actually are that have come to take Jesus. In verse 52, then Jesus said to, you ready? The chief priest, the officers of the temple police, and the elders who had come for him. Jesus is seized by the clergy. This is the pastors and the priest and the denominational heads and the people in charge of religious authority, the temple servants, the people who guard the temple. These are all the people in charge with the sacred trust of working and willing out God's purposes for the people. But what we find here, which is so horrible to consider, but not unfathomable, is that the priest, the pastors, they're coming armed with swords and clubs, led by the betrayer, in order to take Jesus and arrest him and have him done away with. Now, Jesus will love his enemy and he heals his enemy's ear, but he is also going to call these people to account. And he defends himself. And one of the few times he defends himself during these last 12 to 18 hours of his life, he says in verse 52 at the end to these assembly of clergy, have you come out with swords and clubs as if I were just a bandit or a rogue or a violent man? He says, you know what I'm like. Verse 53, when I was with you day after day in the temple, you heard my teaching, you saw me in public, you had opportunity to capture me then, but you didn't lay hands on me. Why? Because they feared the public. They feared what people might do. So he says, the only opportunity you have to do this is in darkness, which belies the fact that what they do is in line with the powers of darkness. That their coming at Jesus here is their coordination under darkness, because the powers of darkness are having their day. And Jesus says, this is the hour. This is the hour of darkness. Now, he's able to say that because he believes that the Son of Man will be vindicated, even if he dies and is executed, that there is an hour of glory as well. And we believe that hour of glory is called the resurrection. That no matter what humankind can do to Christ, that Christ absorbs it all, takes it all, bears our sin in all its horrible forms, denial, betrayal, execution, torture, injustice, and rises again from the grave. Because it is that kingdom which is eternal, the kingdom that Christ has revealed to us. So that's how that text ends. That's the last question he asked to his disciples, but particularly here to Judas. Now, the Jesus Christ Superstar clip I played earlier shows you all of these features, but again in an unconventional and modern way. But there's another song that comes to mind when I hear this account. It's a song that's much more friendly to those of you who like your music a little more mellower, a little more radio-friendly or adult contemporary. It's a song by Michael Card called Why. And if you've heard the song before, you know exactly where I'm going. If you haven't, I want to share with you just the first verse of this beautiful song as Michael Card wrestles with, why did it have to be a friend who chose to betray the Lord? Why is it that Jesus experiences this betrayal by one who was formerly loyal? So, you ready, Louise?
Friend who chose to betray the Lord.
In Michael Card's song, he's wrestling with why did it have to be a friend? And then he comes to the conclusion that one of the things that's unique about betrayal is it always comes from those who we least expect it to come from. Your enemies you expect to oppose you. Your enemies you expect to not care about you. People that are apart from you or that you are not close to, you don't expect much from. But when you have a trusted confidant, you have someone who's loyal to you, someone so loyal to you that when you greet, you share this kiss of affection or this handshake of devotion or this hug of welcome. When the betrayal comes from that person, from those we love the most, it comes in a way that it's a wound of love. It's a wound that comes from a close relationship that has been in some way abused. Anyone who's had children knows that the fact that you enter into a parent-child relationship means there's the possibility or likelihood of betrayal. Anyone who enters into a marriage covenant with a spouse knows that there's a deep love, a deep vulnerability, a deep commitment, and the possibility of betrayal. Anyone who enters into a job relationship or has a close friend or is just in a family, a child in a family, all of those are opportunities in which betrayal, not just denial, but betrayal might wield its ugly head. Jesus, in order to share in all of our struggles, in order to sympathize with our weaknesses, not only experiences the torture and the injustice and the denial of his friends, he experiences what David in Psalm 55 calls his greatest threat, that someone whom he loved, a familiar friend, a close associate, would actually stick the dagger in when it was least likely to have been felt. I know this sounds kind of paltry, but when I think of this, I think of my little kitty cats. I love my cats. I love my dog now, too. But my cats, they do this. You know, cats, when they trust you, they lay on their back and they expose themselves. And, you know, that they're in a very vulnerable position and they love when you rub their belly. How horrible it would be if my cat, whom I had great trust and had developed this relationship, as crazy as that sounds, exposed her belly and I take my heel and just... That's betrayal. Because there's a trust, there's a vulnerability, there's a love, there's a commitment, and I've completely and utterly denied that. We all know that if we're going to enter into close relationships with anyone, that one of the high costs of loving others is the possibility of betrayal. That's why I call betrayal the wound of love. And Jesus experiences that to its full extent. It wasn't enjoyable for Jesus to experience this betrayal. He truly loved Judas. Judas was trusted. He was the treasurer. He was a disciple. They'd shared in struggles and shared in the journey in life for so long. That's why when I think of this story and I think of betrayal, the quote that comes to mind to me so quickly is one I've shared many times before. But for me, this is what's behind my continuing to enter into relationships, knowing that every relationship I enter into holds the possibility of pain. Lewis writes in his book, The Four Loves, to love it all is to be vulnerable. Love anything and your heart will be wrung and possibly broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, you must give it to no one, not even an animal. Wrap it carefully round with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock your heart up safe in the casket or coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, your heart will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. For to love it all is to be vulnerable. The risk of love is great. The alternative, however, is even more horrifying. It is the true hell, the hellish existence of being unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable, invulnerable, which doesn't allow us to enter into the relationships which provide the best source of hope and trust and love, but also always hold out that possibility of denial and betrayal. That's why I want to end this with a famous picture. I used this for children's sermons so that the congregation was ready for this when I gave it to them first service. I showed them this picture, which has been made famous, Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper by the Da Vinci Code. And the Da Vinci Code wanted to make a big deal that there's a hidden Mary in this painting. But I think there's something more going on if you actually look at what the painting's about. The painting is the 12 disciples. And you'll notice that all the disciples, and once you see this, you'll never be able to unsee it, are in, oh, Oh, I wish I had the other side too here. I don't. You notice that all the disciples have certain poses. And they're all kind of going, you know, whoa, not me. Or they're pointing at this person looking at himself. They all are in positions and poses that suggest they're trying to state something. And if you study this painting, you realize that what Da Vinci was trying to highlight was the very moment in which Jesus said, one of you will betray me. And they're all saying, not I, it must be him, it can't be me. They're all in positions of saying, it's not possible that it's me, with one exception. And you'll see this character right here who's not talking to anyone else. Everyone else is talking in groups of three, but there's one person on his own who's got a bag full of 30 pieces of silver. He also, if you pay close attention, there's spilled salt, which in medieval times represented kind of an omen of bad luck that's about to come on him. You'll also see that this person here, which is Peter, has something in his hand, and it's a dagger. That we are seeing in Da Vinci's painting a foreshadowing of what's to come, and they all are denying they are the betrayer, and the one who is the betrayer is there sitting at the table. And I think what this painting forces us to wrestle with more than, you know, is that really Mary beside Jesus, which is just absolute silliness, to be quite honest. What the painting ought to make us wrestle with is, who's at the table that's the hidden betrayer? Because everyone's at the table. And I think if we're very honest, and it may be hard to be this vulnerable before the gospel text, everyone at that table is going to deny Jesus. So no one's going to come out of this looking good. One of them's actually going to betray and hand over Jesus to arrest. And he's going to do that with the sweetest gesture of affection possible, accompanied by the pastors and the priest and the denominational leaders who are going to be right there beside him. And I think that ought to raise in our minds the question of, is it possible that we could betray the Son of Man with a kiss as well? That right alongside the clergy, we do this. Now, I think it's possible. I think that's the risk Jesus takes in entering into relationship with us, but yet he does. He knows Judas is going to betray him. He keeps him there. He knows Judas is going to betray him at this moment, and yet Judas is still at the table with all the deniers that are about to deny him, as Jesus says to them, take, eat, this is my body broken for you. This is my blood shed for you, for the forgiveness of sins. And you find there the kind of love, the love of even enemies, that goes far beyond anything we'd fathom, because it's kingdom kind of love. The good news for me as I look at this painting, and the good news for me as I hear that question, do you betray me with a kiss, is that Jesus shares supper even with Judas, even with the disciples, with the hopes that after they've fallen, they'll come to their senses, get back up, and understand where the real eternal love and life resides, where their true loyalties should be. I would pray that that be true to us as we move forward to the cross and understand it's a hard journey to the cross. Even Jesus' best, most successful, most trusted men fall by the wayside. It's not an easy journey, and yet it is the journey our Lord takes out of love for us. Will you pray with me?